It's 12:07.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kodwo Namdi. You can watch live streaming video of today's Politics Hour and of the legendary Tom Sherwood at kodwoshow.org. He's our resident analyst, a reporter for NBC4, and a columnist for the current newspapers. And Tom, may I ask what it is you were doing at 12:01 a.m. this past Thursday?
You know, I tried to stay up to 12:01, but I didn't make it.
You sound like a grandparent at New Year's.
Well, you know, some of us are old. I'm proud to be the leading edge of the baby boom generation. And about marijuana, I've always said that, you know, we use marijuana as young people, and maybe in retirement we'll use it again.
Well, I know what I was doing, and I was fast asleep at that point, probably dreaming a really pleasant dream of warm summer afternoons at a baseball stadium somewhere drinking beer.
Was it an enhanced dream?
No. No.
No, so I asked the mayor at the press conference this past week, the last question of the news conference. I said to her, "Mayor, will you be up at 12:01? And she got a little smile on her face and said no.
Well, thankfully, we have some enlightened people in the studio today to help us catch up on this week's events. One of them is Patrick Madden. He's our guest analyst today. He's a reporter for WAMU 88.5. Hey, Pat.
Good afternoon.
We also have a lawyer in the House to help sort through what is legal and what is not. According to the District of Columbia, Mary Che is in the studio. She's a member of the D.C. Council. She's a Democrat who represents Ward 3 and chairs the Council's Committee on Transportation and the Environment. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Patrick, what is exactly legal now, according to D.C. government, as of 12:01 a.m. yesterday?
So the city actually did a great job, and they put out an FAQ answering all these questions. But what you need to know is the motto is homegrown, home use. So you can have six plants, three of which can be mature. I really don't know what that means. I just know that's what it says.
I think that means harvestable, but I'm not sure.
2 ounces of marijuana you can basically now have on you, and you can smoke or consume, however you do it. You can do it in your home, but you cannot do it out in public.
Or in your car.
And so what does that mean as far as your porch?
That's a good question.
I think the chief said that the porch is attached to the house.
Right.
That you can.
There is actually a legal concept for this. It's called the curtilage. Anything that's the curtilage.
Sounds like an Olympics game.
I know, but anything
anything
appurtenant to the house that's private, so
appurtenant.
That a back deck, for example, but not the front porch, things of that nature. Now, I'm sure they didn't go into this detail, but I think that that's what they mean. It is an extension of the sort of private part of the house.
Well, legally
front,
or not?
Front porch, yes or no?
No.
I thought the chief said yes on the front porch.
Well,
because we had that problem with people drinking beer on the front porch, and people were arrested or charged. And I thought she said,
well, you know, if you're sitting on the stoop, as they say in some places, and it's open and available and visible to the public, as opposed to perhaps an enclosed front porch, mm-hmm. you know, the idea is to have you do it indoors, mm-hmm. out of sight. And I think that concept of what we use in the law for this purpose might be helpful.
Well, legal issues aside, what are your honest expectations for how your constituents are going to react as people start to participate in this? I'm trying to imagine what the listserv traffic is going to be like in Cleveland Park or in Chevy Chase 3 or 4 months from now when somebody's playing with their kids running through the sprinkler in the front yard and the person next door happens to be enjoying what they now feel like they're able to enjoy in the district.
I think in due course this will settle in, and I think if people comply with the limitations, it's not going to be such a shock or an offense to anyone. So I think it'll all settle out.
If you have questions or comments about the implementation of Initiative 71 in the district, you can join our conversation by calling 800-433-8850. You can email us at kodwo@wamu.org, tweet us at Kodwo Show, or interact with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Kodwo Show. Tom Sherwood.
Yes, that is me.
It's still you.
Well, I thought you were going to go to a caller.
No. We're waiting for the calls to come through.
Even the marijuana subject gets me confused.
Right.
But, many people have said, look, the people who use marijuana, they're not going to go to the trouble of growing. It's just too much trouble to grow plants, and people can't grow tomatoes. So what they'll do is they'll just buy it, and they'll have it in their homes, and they'll discreetly. It sounds to me like the law almost says you better be discreet, but then go ahead and use marijuana, whether you grow it, bring it in from Colorado or Silver Spring.
Well, here's one of the things that's unfortunate. Congress, in its attempt to do something about our referendum, has essentially just stymied us in regulating it in a sensible way, in a coherent way.
Right.
And that's the unfortunate part of it. But people will attempt to get it other than by growing it. I mean, that seems fairly clear. Whether they get it from somebody else in terms of you can give someone else marijuana as long as it's not for sale or for a thing of value. But I just think we would have to be living on another planet to think that sale of marijuana will not exist in the District of Columbia. It already exists in the District of Columbia.
So you don't foresee a big booming garden industry, a lot of green thumbs maybe out there, people learning how to grow
these
plants?
Well, you can't do that, out in your garden. You have to grow it indoors.
That's right, it has to be inside.
Yeah, no one's going to be in the McLean Gardens.
Hydroponics or whatever that word is are going to be very popular.
Right,
except it can be expensive, like $1,200 to set up a decent hydroponic.
I don't know, Tom. Are you aware?
I've been studying this subject.
I see.
He's been doing a lot of research. But I like the way how Adrian Higgins put it in the style section of the Washington Post this morning, that it seems like a lot of the expectation here is that people are going to somehow find access to pot through immaculate conception. They're not paying for it. They don't have a way to necessarily get the seeds, but it's just going to show up and they're going to have
We're having fun with this, but we ought to remember that one of the moving reasons of why this was passed by the voters last year was that the statistics on arrest for minor possession of pot was overwhelmingly showing that 9 out of 10 persons arrested were African Americans in the city, where pot use is pretty uniform around the city, that it was a discriminatory policy or practical discrimination. And that's one of the reasons it's changed. So, and that will continue.
Well, yes, I think the most important thing that we did in that regard happened before this referendum, which is to say we passed legislation decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. Too many people were being caught up in the criminal justice system with all the bad consequences that follow from a conviction for a crime. And so when we did that, it seemed to me that we really made a step forward. And then on top of that, we went back and allowed people who had already been convicted to seek to have those records sealed if it was for possession of a small amount of marijuana and not part of a deal. Sometimes you break down, crimes that you're charged with, and you may be charged with something quite serious, but they allow you to enter a plea to something minor. But I think that was the most important thing we could have done.
And that's what the police chief has said, that the decriminalization law that was passed really was the big step here in terms of people being arrested for marijuana. I mean, I was checking the statistics yesterday. There have been about 100 arrests for just the smoking pot in public because the police union has been concerned about whether they actually can make stops now if someone is smoking marijuana in public because they can't say they smelled marijuana. But the police chief or the police have pushed back against that. But I do think that it was the decrim law that really was the big change here. And the actual changes that we're going to see since this new law went into effect will probably not be that great.
Probably not. And I want to make a point about something, with Congress saying, well, you can't do this and you're going to be in big trouble and you could be subject to arrest and all of the rest of that. The solution that we have, which is not the best because we don't have the opportunity to have comprehensive regulation, but the solution that we have is that the police are simply not going to arrest or bring cases against people for possession of small amounts of marijuana. Even if we didn't have the referendum, this was actually something we were doing some years ago. The U.S. Attorney's Office, now this is some years ago, had made a policy decision that they were not going to prosecute possession of small amounts of marijuana.
Eric Holder made that.
That's correct. And so it basically has the same effect. So when Congress complains about what we're doing, the fact is we're not doing anything. And it's exactly like what we did with immigration policy.
But the House tried to impeach Eric Holder on other issues. They
him. May be true, but it's what we did with immigration issues. I don't know if you all recall this, but the federal government wanted state and local governments to help them deport people, arrest people, prosecute people for being here illegally. And we said in the District of Columbia, where we do have a number of undocumented people, we want cooperation from those people who live here, and we don't want them to run in fear of the police if they're victims of crime, et cetera. So we said our policy was, you know what, you have your federal law, you enforce it. We're not going to arrest.
That's
we're
happened
not
around
hold.
The country in many places.
Right.
Now.
And so this is the same kind of thing, I think, that we're simply saying, you know what, we're not doing this. You have federal enclaves. You can do what you want there. But we're not doing it.
That's one of the issues. And Carl Racine, the attorney general for the city, who was here last week. You know, there's about a fourth of the property in this city, whether it's the Congress, the land around Congress, the National Mall, some of our traffic circles, all of that, are federal properties. And where an overzealous or just an officer thinking he or she's doing his job can arrest you if you have marijuana on your possession, whether you're smoking it or not. Anywhere on the federal property. That's a lot of spaces.
Well, first of all, smoking it
is
going to
everywhere.
Still be prohibited.
Right.
So I would just advise people, you know, on this point, not to smoke it outside, because then they're going to invite trouble. In terms of having possession of it, there would have to be some way that the police would know that you were possessing it.
Would so, be passing it around at a
something like that. But
Fourth of July ceremony.
I do think that the essence of this is to use it in your own private space.
For
what
a
was that the chief
the,
said?
The homegrown home use.
What sort of legal exposure, though, do you think the district officials have regarding whether there's an anti-deficiency component to this? That's what the Congressman Chaffetz was suggesting.
I don't think they have it right on the law because, again—
the Congress.
That's right. Doing nothing is actually— cheap. It's inexpensive. You don't have to spend any money.
For a different take on how complicated things might get at the practical level for people here in the district, we're going to take a call from Kathy in Washington, D.C. Kathy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to point out, because we're an area with many people here on valid non-immigrant visas, students, people working here, this law is not for you. If Customs and Border Protection asks you whether you smoked pot coming in at an airport and you're over 21 and it seems perfectly legal to you, you're violating federal law and you've made yourself ineligible to come into the United States ever unless you obtain a waiver, which is a costly and lengthy undertaking. If you're a student, even if you get the waiver, you may miss a whole year of school and you may not get the waiver. So for anyone who is not a U.S. citizen, just because you're over 21 and you have possessed 2 ounces of marijuana, you know, D.C. police may not arrest you, but if you're in any situation where immigration authorities are involved or you're applying for permanent residency and questioned, you could be in much more difficult situation.
Thanks for your call, Kathy.
That's a really important point.
Mary Chase's response.
No, that's an excellent point, and that shows this difficulty that we're in, where the federal government will still enforce its law, still follow its policies with respect to everything under its purview, and the fact that we have allowed it in the home is not going to insulate you from that if the federal government has jurisdiction over some issue like immigration.
And it's sort of like the issue with public housing. I mean, you can be—
Yes.
If you're in public housing, this law does not apply to you because of the federal dollars that are in play, and that so that's there are all these caveats here with this law.
I've got one more question for you about pot before we move on to some other subjects. What do you think people who are engaged in the broader fight for D.C. autonomy or for D.C. voting rights can learn from how the people who've been engaged on this marijuana issue have gone about it for the past 18 months, however so long they've been gathering signatures and gathering support for Initiative 71? Because when you look at it, they were able to get all the signatures, they were able to mobilize voters, they were able to turn them out, they were able to get some visibility for their issue, get some enthusiasm, some heat for their issue that the broader fight for D.C. voting rights hasn't always gotten.
Well, that's true, but, you know, in terms of getting signatures on petitions and getting something on the ballot, there again, we're doing what we often do is we talk to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's only one dimension. The real sort of airing of the issue in the national press, though, does call to attention the fact that we have this impoverished democracy here. And I wonder how much we're able to penetrate the country at large on that point. But I think any time we have an opportunity to make the point, it's a good thing.
A friend of mine who lives out of the city essentially said, we were talking about this, well, here's how they'll play nationwide. Well, the nation's capital, where the mayor was arrested for smoking crack cocaine, is now defying Congress so the people of the city can smoke dope. That doesn't help statehood arguments.
No, and the issues, the hot-button social issues where it does reach national attention are often ones that are divisive of themselves. And so if you think negatively about Washington, D.C., and if you think differently about some of these social issues, whether it be funding poor women's abortions or marijuana, what gets lost, and you're right, is that what we're talking about is the underlying power imbalance. We don't have the same rights as citizens who live in states.
Can I make one quick point?
Sure.
I think a lot of people have talked about how Mayor Bowser, who's often very cautious in public and almost reads everything she says because she doesn't want to say the wrong thing, stepped up rather boldly, both in the press conferences she held and on the Rachel Maddow show last night. She's been quite aggressive on this. Have you been surprised or just happy that she's done it?
No, and I've been impressed, but I think that here – it's a great opportunity for her because she has a clear path. She wanted to steer between the decision of the voters on the initiative and what she could do without sticking Congress directly in the eye. And I think she found that path by saying we're just going to do nothing about enforcement.
That's Mary Chase. She's a member of the D.C. Council, a Democrat from Ward 3. You're listening to the Politics Hour. I'm Michael Martinez sitting in for Kodjo Namdi today. We're joined, as always, by Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst, and by Patrick Madden, our guest analyst today, a reporter from WAMU 88.5. If you want to join our conversation, you can call us at 800-433-8850 or tweet us at Kodjo Show. And to pivot to a different topic that we talked about last week with the Attorney General for the city, Carl Racine, you've asked him to evaluate whether a proposal to create a prep school for boys of color passes legal muster under Title IX. Racine was here last week, and this is what he said about where he was on the issue.
We're not done yet, but I must tell you, I think that even under the moderate or high-level strict scrutiny, there's every reason to do what government needs to do when there are problems, and that is to devote specific resources and methods that would ameliorate those problems. And here what we're talking about are core issues of education that negatively impact African American boys and brown boys and minority men. We should be able to find a way within the Constitution to elevate the performance of those young boys without prejudicing the rights of others.
Mary Jay, what do you make of that? Sounds like he's got a pretty good idea of what he'd like to do.
Well, I don't know exactly where he's going to come out, but I do think it's pretty clear if we follow the law that no one's saying that you shouldn't target at-risk black boys for special attention. But I am saying that we should look at whether, if you do that, you should leave out the at-risk girls. And if you look at the statistics are really extraordinary in terms of black girls in particular and how they are struggling in the school system. So, we've come down this road before. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the girls shouldn't be invisible. They shouldn't be left to one side. What should happen is we should have program for at-risk children and proceed that way. And that's what I'm asking. I think Title IX and the Title IX regulations are very, very clear that says, they say, you don't have to do the same exact thing, but you have to have comparable help, not depending upon gender.
Were you surprised by the Bowser administration's response to your letter on this issue? I was there at there's a breakfast at City Hall between the council and the mayor, and the mayor really seemed like she took offense at this letter that you sent to the Attorney General, I'll read the quote that she had. She said, "I would appreciate a call, a knock on the door, and not have to read it in the newspaper or on TV."
Well, that she did, give off the air of being annoyed, but that was a sideshow as far as I'm concerned, because she talked about the hallway down to her office. Well, it goes both ways. The proposal, the program, was announced full blown. I read about that in the Washington Post. And I think we should have a full public debate about this, not have little conversations in the hallway, or for us to read about the full-blown proposal in the Washington Post. That's why I'd like the Attorney General to respond to it. And it has generated, I think, the kind of conversation that I think it's worthy of.
Were you surprised, though, even though your letter quite clearly you raised a constitutional issue and an issue that said comparable work ought to be done for girls? And by the way, African-American girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls, and African-American boys are 3 times more likely to be suspended than white boys. But were you surprised? What kind of racial reaction did you get that surprised you?
Well, people, I think, misinterpreted my letter as being opposed to this program for black boys. And it wasn't that at all. In fact, I think the opening line of my letter to the Attorney General was, "I applaud having this program and have it targeted to the problems of black boys." What I want, what I was hoping would come out of this, and I hope may still come out of this, which is what the law requires, that there be comparable efforts to help our African-American girls who are struggling, who are at risk. I just don't think that we should think of them as, oh, they're fine, just whatever, they can wait.
Secondary or invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So then what you were trying to do is start a conversation. You didn't have an outcome in mind that you were trying to get to.
No, in a sense, I do have an outcome. I want black boys, black girls who are struggling, at-risk kids, to be helped. And I want them to be helped because they're at risk and because they're struggling, not because you have a boy or a girl. And again, you can target particular efforts, but you have to have comparable efforts.
And we're talking about also Latino boys and girls, too.
Yes.
Let's take a call here. We're going to go to Ron in Washington, D.C. Ron, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing? I just want to say that I don't get up into the political. I don't want to get into political or what's legal or not, because, you know.
Hold on. I think I recognize which Ron this is. This is Ronald Moten, former candidate
former
for the D.C. Council.
Republican candidate for the D.C. Council.
Frederick Hi, Ron.
Douglas, Republican. Hey,
Frederick Douglass, Republican.
Creator of many great political music videos.
Yes.
Well,
maybe, Ron, you could rap for us what your question is.
He doesn't perform in the video. He doesn't do the music. He just,
okay.
Hey, Shay Shay.
Anyhow, go ahead, Ron.
What's your question?
I don't want to get into what's right or wrong, but I just think that, you know, the Underground Railroad was wrong, but it was morally right? And I think with the thing with the boys is a great thing. I commend the administration for doing it. But I just think that we must also do what we need to do for the girls simultaneously, because if you look at Ward 8, only 9% of the families, the youth 15 and 17 years old, are raising intact families, which means most of them are going to be raised by the girls. And if the girls are messed up, I don't care what initiative or buzzword you put out there, the boys are going to be messed up too. We know that from working with the girls, studying the civil rights movement and everything. The girls help pull the boys up. But one of the facts that I saw, the data that really we must pay attention to, is that girls are 3 to 4 times more likely to be incarcerated if they had bad grades or if they expelled from school. So we must understand that this is very, very serious. And we're going to be having a discussion about this. Natalie Hopkinson is going to be moderating at Bus Boys and Poets on Wednesday. Like I said, I commend the mayor for what she's done, because that is long overdue. But our girls over the last 10 years in the district in Columbia and in America, they going through so much abuse, so much neglect. You got the sex trafficking going on. You got so many things going on with them. And things they're doing, they're 29% of the population going into the youth system now in Washington, D.C., 29%. And a lot of the crimes they're committing there are violent.
Okay, Ron, I'm going to let Mary J. in to respond here. Thanks so much for your call.
Well,
okay, all right, thanks.
Thank you for that, Ron. And, you know, the other thing, which is part of what you were talking about, you know, I've gone over to D.C. General to see the families that are homeless over there, that are housed over there. And it's really quite troubling when you see young women, sometimes girls, having babies because of teenage pregnancy, dropping out of school, having babies. Who bears the brunt of the social ills that affect us? I think girls bear it perhaps disproportionately, but again, I just don't think we're looking close enough to see the kinds of things that Ron Moten was pointing out.
We're talking about a policy empowering black young males and Latinos, but this is a policy being put together by an African-American mayor and an African-American chancellor of schools, Kaya Henderson. Both females.
Well, that's true, but I'm asking them to open their eyes, too. Now, I shouldn't get into this, but the mayor said, well, you know, I was one of those little black girls, too. But no, not really. Not middle class, not an intact family, not attending private schools. We're talking about people who are really falling off the edge. That's what we're talking about. And I think we need to, again, I'm very happy that we're having this conversation because it has now, I think, I hope, educated people to the very significant difficulties that at-risk girls have.
Back to the legal issues at work here. We just got an email from John who says, I'm a lawyer and I know the council member is a constitutional law professor. So my question is, who would have standing to be a proper plaintiff to challenge a gender segregated school?
Well, that's kind of interesting because there is an all-boys or all-girls school still operating somewhere with government
Chicago,
money,
yeah.
By the way. And
Chicago,
what we're talking about.
Urban.
So what you'd have to have is someone who, a female, who would want to avail herself of programs that are available only for males. You know, when VMI, which was a government-supported military institute, a college, when VMI was operating all male, it took a woman to apply there and to be rejected in order to have standing. And so you'd have to have something along those same lines.
What about just the process of this whole proposal? They've already picked out which group is going to run the school. I think it's Urban Prep, and so I'm not sure. But it seems like they've already have this thing figured out. But there are still all these thorny legal issues that need to be addressed. Can you talk about sort of the process of?
Yes, you know, since it is mayoral takeover, and by the way, at that same breakfast with the council, it was only then that I realized that this proposal really had its beginnings under Mayor Gray, because I believe the chancellor said that we've been studying this for 6 to 8 months, which would then be in an earlier administration, so they presumably think that they have everything in order, but as I said, I'm quite uncertain. I'd like the Attorney General to look at this. And what I hope to come out of this is that we not, slow up on helping at-risk boys, but that we add the girls.
I'm going to take one more call on this issue from Alicia in Washington, D.C. Alicia, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Kojo.
Oh, hey, it's not Kojo. I'm Michael Martinez sitting in for Kojo today, but I'll tell him you said hi.
Well, hello, Michael Martinez, and is that Mary Kay?
Yes.
Yeah, so, well, my name is Alicia, and I'm a student at Howard University, and Howard University initiated a program for African-American males that was similar, I think, to the type of, you know, initiative that the D.C. government is now, doing. And there's no alternative or no parallels for the women at the university. And I'm just wondering if there had been any coordination, any discussion, or if you could give any suggestions of what you might be able to do to get the, you know, the administration to provide some programs for the African-American women at Howard.
Well, you know, the hook here is whether the school is a government-funded school. Is Howard?
Yes.
Government-funded?
It gets a lot of money from Congress.
Well, then it seems to me that if there are programs that are helping the males, then the female should attempt to avail themselves of it, and being denied should challenge it. But short of going to the mat about it, maybe approaching the administration and saying, what is it that you're doing, and why are you not helping the females as well?
Thanks for your call, Alicia. Sorry about that. It looks like we
Councilmember, we're taking a little time. Michael is letting me ask a couple of quick questions. All right. First of all, streetcars. You're the chairman of the Transportation Committee. When I interviewed you a couple of weeks ago, you were saying that the mayor and the council and you ought to talk about the streetcar system. It's so troubled that, and you suggested even then that maybe the whole system would be cut back to a much smaller system. Where are you on that?
Well, you know, things were put in abeyance because of the fact that we had a switch in administrations, and then we had, you know, drift in the Department of Transportation, very significant and serious drift, and then now we have a new director. The new director has wanted to take some time to evaluate the whole program. I know the mayor wants to focus on that. I had some legislation that I pulled back for, you know, reforming some of the transportation initiatives that we have. So we're in a state now of trying to reassess, and I don't think we've come to any firm
conclusion.
But
on Saturday night, the streetcar was on fire.
But that was just a little incident. But likely, at least, it seems to me, everyone I've spoken to on background in the department, in the mayor's administration, is that we are going to pull back significantly on the streetcar. It's just a matter of how much and when, and that her budget coming out in April will indicate that.
I think it's fair to say that
that
the
I'm
whole,
right.
Well, I'd love to say that, but, you know, I don't want to be rash. I think it's fair to say that the entire streetcar program, as was originally perhaps envisioned, is
not going to happen.
Possibly not going to happen.
Okay. One more issue. I'm going to save death with dignity to the last. Pepco Exelon merger. You're opposing it.
Well, I'm going to send out a letter that essentially opposes it. I don't think it's not up to the council. It's up to the Public Service Commission. They're supposed to decide whether it's in the public interest. I don't think the public interest will be served by that merger.
Why?
Why? For a number of reasons. One, I do think. First of all, I'll tell you who will be served. Pepco shareholders will be served, and Exelon Corporation will be served. The Exelon Corporation is an energy supplier. Pepco is an energy distributor. It has no conflict of interest in what we are doing in the district, which is basically moving rapidly to renewables, moving rapidly to energy conservation. They want to sell more energy. We want to save energy. We're concerned about climate control. We're concerned about all of these things. I think in the end, our efforts, if not stopped, will certainly be blunted by joining hands with this company. In addition, Pepco, though we pick on it, you know, it's our company, it's local, it's accessible. Exelon says, no, you'll have your local representatives here. No, it'll be a distant corporation, and our ability to have any influence over their behavior will be diminished.
Patrick, one last question before we move
on. And there's more, but okay.
Well, just does the council have to approve this deal?
No.
And what is your fear for everyday district residents if this merger goes through?
I think for everyday district residents, although they're talking about this thing called ring fencing, they're going to put a fence around our fees and our costs when you go to the Public Service Commission for a rate increase and not involve Exelon's problems with its facilities and its costs, that'll only last a period of time. And there's also creative accounting. I think that the end result for the retail customer, higher costs.
Mary Chair, we're going to have to leave it there. Hopefully the next time we see – oh, you want to ask one last question?
Dignity.
All right, one last question before we move
on. There's a movement across the country, Death with Dignity, to make it easier for people at the end of their lives to end their lives. Just very quickly, tell us where you are in the city on that. It's been introduced in Maryland. It's a big issue nationwide.
I introduced the law here, and it follows the Oregon model, which is to say that if a person has a 6 months to live and a diagnosis that they only have 6 months to live, a terminal illness, that they can, under very, very restrictive circumstances, just like in Oregon, seek out medical assistance to get medication to end their lives. And it would be self-administered. And as I said, there are a lot of fences around this and protections around this. But what I have found and what I think is true, and certainly been true in all the years in Oregon, What people want is, and not that many people take advantage of it, but what people want is the opportunity to have control at the end of their lives. A third of the people who get the medication don't even use it. And they say that what they wanted was the opportunity, if they chose, to use the medication.
The clarity of the decision. Thank you.
Right.
A lot to catch back up on the next time we see it, which hopefully will be when this polar vortex is finally over. Mary J., thanks so much.
Well, we don't have
to
wait that long.
Right. We'll do it in the spring. I'm hoping that it'll be warmer like next week and not 6 weeks.
It will be. It'll be in the 50s next week when I'm on vacation.
You're constantly on vacation, Tom.
That's what my editors say.
Mary J., thanks so much for joining us. We'll
see
you again soon.
Okay.
You're listening to the Politics Hour. I'm Michael Martinez sitting in for Kojo Namdi today. We're joined, as always, by Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst, a reporter for NBC4, and a columnist for the current newspapers, and by Patrick Madden, our guest analyst today. He's a reporter for WAMU 88.5. And we are monitoring elections that are taking place in the district right now. There's a special election for Ward 4, a special election for Ward 8. There's something 140 candidates running for these two different seats. I saw this morning that one of them has dropped out in Ward 8, Nate Bennett Fleming, which leaves about 15 candidates on the ballot there. Patrick, where are we here on these races, starting with Ward 4?
Well, I think just in both races, we're starting to sort out who the top tier candidates are going to be. And I think they're, you can look at, you know, we hate saying, you know, look at the money, but sort of that's one way you can figure out which candidates are serious, also endorsements. So I think you're starting to see the endorsements. You're starting to see which candidates have raised a lot of money. We know Brandon Todd is going to be, considered a favorite in the race because he's been endorsed by Mayor Bowser.
Brandon Todd's had issues that has been disclosed that as a young person, I think college student, he had a bankruptcy of $20,000.
Doug Sloan, one of his opponents, is trying to make hay about how he used to be a Republican.
He was a registered Republican.
A former Republican. And thirdly, another issue is that he has misrepresented where he lived on his application. Whether or not those are disqualifying, I'm not certain. He says it's not. But it is an issue that's being raised with him, all these little nicks in his campaign. But he is the most well-funded candidate.
What about Ward 8? Marion Christopher Barry is still out there, at it?
To his credit, Marion Christopher Barry hasn't been in the news for at least 10 days. But I mean,
he has the endorsement of former council member Jim Graham, I saw.
Well, yes, that's true. Jim Graham has tried to help Christopher on a variety of issues in his personal life. So I just think that it's Christopher's has to demonstrate that he can get people to the polls. This is elections where people know you, they'll come vote. He has no demonstrable record of community service or activity in Ward 8 other than helping his father occasionally.
And you have to raise just a minimal amount of money to help in
that.
And
very strong candidates. I'm going to do a forum with the candidates on March 25th with Thurgood Marshall School, and we'll see how that works out. I'm anxious to see what the candidates are saying a month before the election.
Good luck with that. You'll have people talking in like 30-second increments just to fit all of them in.
I can be a pretty tough moderator.
I've seen that before. Well, one person who will not be running for election just joined us in the studio. That's Walter Tejada, a member of the Arlington County Board. He's a Democrat. Walter, we haven't spoken to you on this show since you decided that you were not going to seek re-election the next time your seat was up in the Democratic primary. Why did you decide this was the right time to walk away?
Well, first, you're not Kojo Namdi.
I am not Kojo Namdi. And I will not try to say his name that way either.
Hope he's enjoying his outing. Thank you for inviting me, and it's great to be here. And yes, I've decided that after almost 13 years, by the time I'm done serving this year, my full four-year term, that it's time for me to focus on other things. Over the last couple of years, I've turned down three wonderful opportunities. I think I'm open to see what else I might be able to do, but I certainly will continue to be involved in my community and advocate for the issues that I've been working on. You're not going to be surprised at some of the issues that I, of course, have been involved. Will continue to advocate for the rest of my term.
Let some other people join the conversation. If you want to talk to Walter Tejada, you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kojo Show or email us at kojo@wamu.org. Tom Sherwood.
Are you quitting because your big project, the streetcar, was blown up and didn't go forward?
I wouldn't.
Was that an emotional part of the decision or was that a practical part?
I reject the word quitting or retiring, as people have said. I am moving on, and there's a number of elements. First, let me make sure also to say that it's been an enormous privilege and a downright honor to serve the residents of Arlington as an elected official. Not too many people get to serve elected office in this country, so I'm honored. The streetcar will go down as one of my major disappointments, in all fairness. I think that...
Can you name another one?
But, you know, it's not about me. It's about the countless numbers of people that went through a very legitimate public process, totally vetted, with best practices in having a package that would have required in the Columbia Pike area zero single-family home taxpayer dollars to make it happen, leveraging dollars from the state, regional, and even the governor had allocated $65 million very recently before it was canceled, which would have saved us $25 million in a year's time. So, and, by the way, that was supposed to spur economic development, as well as preserving not some, but all of the affordable housing, which was one of the big requirements for me. So it's a major disappointment indeed.
And we were just talking about, you know, the streetcar situation here in D.C., which is going through its own troubles right now. What is it about the streetcar system, do you think, that is so difficult to finally to, you know, you can bring the right plans, you can create the right funding, but getting it done seems to be very difficult.
And I'll piggyback off that, though. When you see photos like the one people were circulating on the internet on Saturday night of the D.C. streetcar on fire, and you look at all the trouble that D.C.'s had getting their project off the ground, do you ever think to yourself, well, maybe this is actually a good thing we're not moving forward with the one in Arlington?
I categorically reject that.
Okay.
I think that it's always easy to denigrate, attack, and be negative about something, be creative, all of this energy. People who are angry always seem to be ones that come out and have their voices heard more, and they've got well-paid negative campaigns to make things happen. But you ought to look at also Philadelphia, Portland, and other places where streetcars are simply part of the landscape. They're great transportation options that are designed to move more people. And in areas like where we are in, where we have a growing population, you need vehicles that have capacity that can move larger people. We, you know, in Arlington, our streetcar project called for enhanced bus system as well. It wasn't that. There weren't going to be any buses. So we have that. But you have a modern transportation system in an area very diverse of the county, much more diverse than the northern part of the county, that had been lacking in revitalization. And this was bringing that tool that would have generated many other good components.
But if it's so great, why did it fail?
So, you know, people in Arlington
didn't want to pay for something they weren't going to benefit from.
Well, I think it's also part of designing a financing package that makes sense. I think the ones we had did make sense. Part of the problem also, and this is a big one, that it takes too darn long for the federal government, for example, to process applications for these type of infrastructure projects that will help revitalize an area or will inject new energy to it. So I think that has to – one of the things, if I were to suggest to folks, really at the federal level more than anywhere else, is that you need to find ways to shorten the time that it takes for these kinds of things. And in big infrastructure projects, which are strategic investments for localities, too many times the cost escalates. And I think part of the problem is sometimes the cost, that you say one figure and then the construction material cost goes up, and so you have an updated figure, and you give that to the residents. They say, see, you now give me a different figure. And in order to be transparent, I think that people need to understand that infrastructure projects take a while, but they are strategic investments that we have to stick to, because otherwise we're going to be doing flavor of the month. And Arlington has not been known to be a flavor of the month. We planned strategically, and
the Arlington way.
And the Arlington way. And the rejection of the streetcar was a really bad step backwards
well,
for Arlington.
Mayor Bowser in the district has talked about rapid bus, that she likes rapid bus. Yeah. She was on the Metro board. Montgomery County has a proposed 81-mile, 115-station bus rapid transit program that it might introduce. Some people have suggested that in Arlington, rapid bus would be better than the hard rail lines of streetcars. Are we going to just move to buses? I think you've said before, and if Governor Hogan kills the Purple Line in suburban Maryland, even as this region explodes in population, virtually every jurisdiction is changing the way people are going to be getting around.
Yeah, I hope that Purple Line goes on, but that's my humble opinion. I think that also the part that is important to pay attention is the middle in the middle letter in that acronym BRT, because in order for it to function correctly, and in those places that you mentioned, I hope they have dedicated lanes for it, because that's how truly you do have bus rapid transit that moves quickly, that in dedicated lanes. In Arlington, we are not allowed by the state to dedicate a lane of the two lanes in each direction in Columbia Pike. They have one in each dedicated to the bus. We just simply cannot do that. So it was very disingenuous for those who were suggesting that somehow that would happen, or the articulated bus system, which are heavy buses that roads cannot handle, that somehow that would be at a fraction of the cost. So that was part of the negative, what I call the choir negativity, that attacked our project with misinformation, leading people to believe that somehow this was that was a better deal. How many times have you heard those who oppose the streetcar say BRT since the project was canceled?
Well, in terms of people who oppose the streetcar, what concerns do you have about the ideological direction of the board, especially now that both you and Mary Hines are moving away?
The first one is to be honest and to really use factual information. That I think the language that we use could mislead residents who are not tuning into the minute details and maybe just go by sound bites. First of all, there has to be a proposal for an alternative. Okay. You were able to kill the streetcar, and now what? What is your alternative? Where is your plan? Not just rely on staff to come up with something. What is your specific vision? Just like we did when we worked together with the community through our advisory commissions, the neighborhood, and all that, look at all the alternatives, including our own specific vision as board members, as elected officials, to hammer out a solution that was the alternative that the community wanted. So I think it's important that those who opposed the streetcar and wanted to kill it, ask those who led the choir negativity toward it, okay, where's your solution? Where's your alternative?
But his larger question is, what is the ideological posture of this board? Is it changing dramatically? Chris Zimmerman's no longer there. You're leaving. I mean, what's changing as the county is growing rapidly? What's changing?
Well, within our 26 square miles of space, I think it's a great honor to have served with Paul Ferguson, Chris Zimmerman, Barbara Favola,
you already said it was
Mary
an honor
Hines,
to serve. You can't go over that track again.
And Jay Fissette, people who are true progressives and have a vision
for
progressive values.
Are you saying the county is getting more conservative?
Well, I think the voters...
I'm just trying to press you here because we're not getting any more chances. You're going to be out of office.
Well, unfortunately, the period of the time we have, it's important to remind voters that if we want to keep Arlington a strong Democrat stronghold, as I would like, and as I said in my initial statement, I'm an unapologetic progressive. Mm-hmm. And so if someone wants to change, you need to come out to the voting and vote and have your voice heard. I'd reject this thing about fusion candidate or somewhat also with Republicans. What have the Republicans done for Democrats but obstruct, just like they're doing now at the national level, holding hostages of security, holding the money from the Department of Homeland Security, and just being obstructionist. I mean, you know, so we have to decide in Arlington whether we are no longer going to be progressive and Democrats, or we are now changing that. There, in all fairness, has been a change in demographic. Arlington has been the county that has gotten less diverse than others in the Washington metro region. So you look at that.
You mean
that
there are more white people now than there were?
Well,
it's the Latino population going up or down?
It's holding steady now. It was declining for some time. But you know, when you look at the results of the last election, where the choir negativity anti-streetcar movement was mostly for North Arlington and in some South Arlington support, but the candidate who was running against the streetcar lost the election in the Columbia Pike precincts. And that is 65% of the population is diverse. So folks can make their own conclusions about what they want,
well,
but those are facts.
I want to ask you a question about what the streetcar was meant to do to bridge the divides, the economic disparities between North Arlington and South Arlington. Now that that's off the table, what are some of the things you think the board would be wise to consider that would help them sort of bridge those gaps? Because that's been a big part of what you've been up to on the board.
I think part of what we're doing is an invitation to those residents who, in Arlington, what we have is first world problems. We have one of the wealthiest counties in the United States. And in September 2013, we were $137,000 per household in average. That was $10,000 more than even Loudoun County. So, and I'm not sure what the ranking is today, but an average home in Arlington is costs around $600,000. So you put a house like that in another county where the tax rate is higher, you might pay more and so on. So I would say there are many ways to look at what we have in Arlington and the importance of fighting to protect that. And one of the ways is to our community facilities study that we're doing right now, where we're asking folks to participate and weigh in. And not just tune in when you're angry, but follow the conversation as much as possible through listservs or downright weighing in, board meetings. You don't have to also come in public comment, but, you know, attend the conversation. There are 20 over 20 citizens we have appointed to have a conversation throughout the community. What are we going to do with public facilities with the population growth, school enrollment that is continuing to escalate, and are we maximizing our facilities? For instance, we have a Madison Community Center in northern part of Arlington. Is that serving the best that it can to our community? You know, so we need to look at other and what we can do to co-locate. Can we do a community center where we have affordable housing or somewhat of a school component or some other element? There's nothing in Arlington today that we should consider without thinking multi-use. So I hope that the residents will continue to pay attention to that because it's not a done deal. Doesn't mean that we're set on what we're going to do, but we at least should evaluate those things given that we have space limitations.
Are you concerned for the Hispanic community in Arlington now that you're not going to be there, that they will not have a strong voice to represent their interests?
Well, my slogan is four words, for all of Arlington. So I've made it a priority to represent all residents. There's no question that I do have a particular point of view from the Latino community as I cut my teeth through advocating and fighting for human rights, civil rights, social justice, and those things will continue. That's not going to change. I would say that I'm hoping that what I have established and left behind that could sustain itself, but that will be up to the voters, you know, because people can give you a nice lip service when it comes to taking action. For example, in 2007, one of the actions that I'm most proud in Arlington was at the height of the xenophobic anti-immigrant sentiment that was ramping across the nation after the failure of then immigration reform, local governments were acting as if they had the constitutional authority to do that. They don't. So we said in Arlington, wait a minute. We're going to look at how our immigrant community, whatever immigration status has, is contributing to it and then talk about it. And we did. We passed a resolution unanimously in support of immigrant community and then changing some of the environment here because some jurisdictions not far from us we're having this persecution toward immigrants. And believe me, it's one of the things I'm most proud of because
Prince
it's changed.
County.
Well, you know, you can name names if you like, but, you know.
No, I'm just
saying
it sounded like you said Prince William County,
well,
but I didn't quite hear you say
this
it.
This is one of those, if the shoe fits, wear it. You know, so it's one of those things that, you know, changed the District of Columbia also passed a similar resolution right after us. So, you know, we really want to make people feel that they're part of the community. I'm just going to use this last example. When we don't do that,
then you've got about 30 seconds.
Well, you know, COJO participate in our diversity of dollars. When we don't make the community feel part of, you can have extremism behavior like we do in some places around the world. And we want our community to be feel part, not against. That's why, you know, I think Republicans need to get their act in Congress and make sure that we get immigration reform.
Well, Walter Tejada, it's been fun. Thanks so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank
Vamos
you for
United.
Inviting me. Hopefully next time we have a little more time. I'm happy to come
soccer
back.
Season starts soon. Tom, Patrick, pleasure as always.
Happy to be here, as usual.
COJO will be back next week. I'm Michael Martinez. I've been sitting in for COJO Nomni today. Thanks so much for listening. Coming up Monday on the COJO Nomni Show, hacks, heists, and the future of cybercrime. Technology's earliest adopters are often the first to exploit weaknesses. What it will take to stop the next generation of cybercriminals. Then at 1, American history's familiar figures, forgotten names, and myths in need of debunking. A 200-year historical tour with Smithsonian curator Tim Grove. The COJO Nomni Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Good afternoon. Heading up to 1 o'clock now, we're getting word that Leonard Nimoy, Spock from Star Trek, the series and the movies, has died.
Thanks for listening to the COJO Nomni Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button and thanks.